think that it sounds like we're picking it up all right. That's what it looks like. Mm-hmm. So what I'll do is just sort of prompt you with some questions, and
I hope I can answer them.
Oh, I'm sure. To begin with, let me indicate for the record that today is November 14th.
November the 14th.
And this is Jim Boning speaking with Dr. Thomas Mastin at his home in Waite Hill, Ohio. Dr. Mastin, I know you were born in Newcastle, Indiana.
That's right.
Was it 1913? I'm not sure of the year and the date.
December 19th, 1913.
Could you tell me something about your parents and your family background?
Well, my father worked in a steel mill, and he died when I was 11 years old. And my mother was sort of destitute after that because the family had very little money, but she had to take in washings and the neighbors, and we even had a boarder come in a small house and stay there and make enough money to buy food for the kids. That was a pretty bad situation there for quite a while. She finally got married again and a number of years later, and that helped the situation quite a bit. There were six of us children in the family. The oldest daughter of our parents died when I was young. She was 12 years older than I was, and she died of pneumonia when she'd been married when she died. That's about it, I guess.
You received all of your early education in Newcastle?
Right.
You listed on your form that you filled out that there was a Mr. Bronson in high school who had an influence on your life.
That's true. He was a chemistry teacher there in Newcastle High School. And I'm not quite sure how I decided to take a course in chemistry, but I did. And he seemed to take a liking to me, and he'd even take me out to his home in the evenings and teach me more than I learned in the class, gave me some books to read, and I really became fascinated with the subject of chemistry, primarily because of his attention to me. And he was a great teacher. I don't know if he did that with other students, but he probably did, and inspired most of them very well.
I understand that you were contemplating leaving school at 16 because you didn't find it very interesting until this particular course.
That's true. I told my mother that I was going to quit school at the age of 16. I had to go that far according to the law of Ohio, or Indiana, I guess. But I started taking chemistry and decided I'm not going to quit.
You then went on to Wabash College, but I'm not sure when you started at Wabash. And why did you go there?
Because Mr. Bronson graduated from there, and he recommended Wabash to me. And I started in Wabash, let's see, I got out of high school about 32. I don't know if it was 32 or 33, something like that.
Well, this was the depths of the Depression.
Yeah.
How did you finance your college education?
Well, I had to come home every summer and work in a steel mill. That's the same one that my father worked in. And I earned enough money to go back and pay the tuition for the next year or whatever. When I graduated from Wabash, I owed them $1,200 because they helped me out in a few cases there. I paid it off after I made enough money.
What was the chemistry department like at Wabash?
Well, Dr. L.V. Howell was the head of the chemistry department, and that's who all the courses I took was under him. And he had the reputation of being the toughest teacher in the whole college, and he was. The first course I took, he had the first exam I took in the class. He came in on the blackboard and he had all the grades on a line on the blackboard from the highest down to the lowest. And he said that the ones that are at the lowest here are going to get kicked out of this class. And he kicked them out, including his own son. But he taught chemistry in a very effective way. And I did research for him for 1 year after I graduated, actually, because Wabash wouldn't let me take chemistry in the first year because it's a liberal arts school. They wanted you to concentrate on that liberal arts. So I didn't take chemistry the first year. So when I graduated, I wanted to go to the University of Illinois because Dr. Howell recommended that to me. I had one course that they were required to get into Illinois, and I hadn't taken it because I missed that first year. So I stayed another year and took the course and also did some research under Dr. Howell's direction. And he gave me a project that was to make a metal acetylide, and none had ever been made before, ever been reported in the literature. I can't remember if it was sodium acetylide or something like that. Well, I finally got it made, and I was weighing out the dried sample in a very expensive balance in the laboratory. And while it was drying, I was turned the other way, fortunately. The darn thing blew up and wrecked the balance and everything. Well, we wrote a paper saying, don't ever make this thing. That's the first time it was ever made, and didn't know it was going to blow up. Of course, the satellites are very important, are very explosive anyway. Now, that's about my education at Wabash, I guess.
Were there many other chemistry majors?
About four. It was a small school, about 400 students. And I think, while I was in the lab anyway, there was about three others, or maybe three or four others with me, doing research in the labs.
Was Howell an organic chemist?
Yeah.
And you went to Illinois then on his recommendation?
All right.
What was it like at Illinois when you got there?
Well, it was kind of interesting because the first day all the new freshmen in chemistry were called together, and the dean got up and said, we've got enough space here to take all you people this year, but 30% of you are not going to be back next year because we'll be out of space, out of room. So here I was going through the first year saying, am I going to pass this thing or not? That was just as tough as a Wabash. In many ways, more difficult. And I passed it well enough to continue on there. And I did okay on my grades. There's one experience I'll never forget. If you want me to continue talking
please,
these things.
Please.
I was taking thermodynamics. And the professor in that course was known as very difficult, and he gave one exam in the middle of the semester, or maybe near the end, I don't know, and that was that exam counts for half of your credits, and your papers you put in the meantime for half of them. Well, the three blackboards in that room were covered with questions, and I got through them all. I knew the questions. I knew the answers. But unfortunately, and I can't understand this, I didn't see the last question on the board. I thought I was through. And everybody was still sitting there working. And I checked everything out, and I said, well, I might as well get up and leave. Well, I got a C on that. And you get a C in graduate school, that's bad. So I go back in and see this professor. How's come I got a C? He says, you didn't answer the last question. And I said, well, son of a gun, I didn't even see that on the board. And I said, I'll take the whole exam over. Give me more different questions. No way. I could not talk him into doing anything to prove that I knew this course. So I was worried about being kicked out because they were tough over there. A C is no good in graduate school. But I hung in and stayed until I graduated. I'll never forget that old guy. He was, I can't imagine anybody that mean.
How did you begin your association with Carl Marvel?
He's the one I did my doctor's degree under. He was my whatever they call it. I worked for him and did the research under him. And I took some courses that he wasn't involved in, like this thermodynamics and that sort of thing, inorganic chemistry, all these things. But I did my thesis in organic chemistry working on vinyl polymers. Those were new in those days. And, well, we wrote two or three papers, and or he did. You probably got them in your collection.
Did you select Marvel, and why did you select him to work for?
I don't know. I think, I'm not sure of this, but I think he was, I'd heard from others that he was probably the best teacher there, and in organic. So I'm not sure how I got to work for him in my thesis, but I knew he was a good man there, and I probably went to talk with him. I can't remember the details of it.
And it was he who introduced you to birds, or had you had an interest in birds before that?
He introduced me. I went out with him a number of weekends looking at birds, and, you know, he told me one time if he had it all a do-over, he would be an ornithologist and not a chemist, because he loved birds so much. And he inspired a lot of students. So I remember going out with a whole gang of, well, maybe 10, 15 people from a school along the lake somewhere over there in Champaign, Urbana, with Marvel and looking at birds and so forth. That's how I got interested in birds, at least in part.
And you've pursued that all your life, haven't you?
Yes, I'm not an expert at it, but I've done a lot of photographing. That's my hobby, and of birds, and I've been out with a number of different people on bird watches, so-called. But I'm not like some of them that know every bird in the country.
Well, you have a marvelous location here, too, for yeah. I'm sure there are lots of birds here.
Yeah. I feed them all year long, and I know all of them around here anyway. I think I do.
I noticed a number of snow geese coming out. Do they winter here now? Are they wintering here?
They do come through here migrating. I don't believe they stay over winter.
Okay. Because where I'm living outside of Philadelphia, there are a number of them that stay there all winter long.
Uh-huh. There may be some of them do that. Well, that, matter of fact, I know I saw one in the late fall, at least, down on the pond. There's a pond down below here. So they may stay all winter.
When you were in Illinois, of course, Illinois had the reputation, probably one of the finest chemistry departments in the country. Still does, but at that time it was certainly a powerhouse.
Yeah.
What had you thought about doing when you were, well, the war had started. You got your PhD in 42, so the war had already started.
Yeah.
But had you, what thoughts were you giving to your career as you were working through your graduate program?
Well, I graduated in 42, and you know the American Chemical Society has two meetings a year. I was a member, a student member of that, and I know they had a clearinghouse for graduates looking for jobs. So in the fall of 42, I went to the meeting in Nashville, Tennessee. They have them all over the country, various places. I put my resume in this clearinghouse file, and I was interviewed by three or four different chemical companies, but I made up my mind, probably even before I went down there, that I was not going to take a job with a big company, big chemical company, like DuPont, Celanese, or I didn't want to go with one of those companies.
Why didn't you want a big company?
Well, I know what I said to myself. I said, a big company, I would just be a spoke in another big wheel. And I don't want to be that way. And that was all my thinking that I put on it. And so there was a fellow came to interview me by the name of Carl Prutton. You may know him.
Studied his physical chemistry text.
Yeah, he was a case tech at the time, head of the department. And he was a consultant for Cleveland Industrial Research, which I didn't never heard of. But he interviewed me and told me that he was looking for somebody for Cleveland Industrial Research. I said, well, how many research people do they have? He said, seven. Well, that's all. And that company was operating and doing research in the laboratories, the basement laboratories of Case Tech at that time. One of the founders of Lubrizol had set up that as an arm of the research department of Lubrizol. That's the only place they had to go. They were building a new lab out in Wickliffe here. Excuse me. So I worked in that basement laboratory at Case Tech for a few months with these other six chemists, and then we moved out to the new research building in Wickliffe. And they didn't have anyone in that group that had a PhD degree. But there was a head of the laboratory by the name of Del Fry. So he was my boss. And he hated my guts. I couldn't do anything right for him. You want the rest of this story?
Sure, sure.
So I just couldn't please him no matter what it is. I even made a compound there in the lab that was patented, but it didn't make any difference. So I decided, if I can last for a year, I'm going to get out of this place. Because I didn't want to get fired before a year, and then I'd have a hard time getting another job out here. So I went through this mess for 9 months. And then Calvin Smith, one of the founders of the company, is who I interviewed me when I was hired, asked me to come in his office, and I thought, oh, I'm going to get fired. I was sure that he's the one that would do it. Well, I sat down in front of his desk, and he chatted with me a little while, and then he said, I understand you and Del Frey are making out. I said, that's right. I can't do anything right. I can't do anything that he approves. And then he says, well, you think you know how to run a laboratory? I said, no, I don't know how to run a laboratory. I've never had any experience like that. I just wanted to be a chemist at the bench and hopefully make some products that are worthwhile. And then he said, well, would you like to try running a laboratory? I was still sort of upset, and I said, I'll try anything once. That was not a good answer. But then he said, okay, you've got the job. They've never told me, but I'm sure that Prutton went down to Tennessee to find someone to head up that new lab. I was never told that, though, anytime, afterwards or before. So I got to head up the research lab 9 months after all this hard luck I was having with Fry.
What kind of things did he have you doing?
Del Frey? Well, making, synthesizing different products that might be useful in lubricants. And I was working on sulfur compounds, phosphor compounds, things like that. I made a product at one time that didn't work in the lubricants, but it since then, it was turned out to be one of the best insecticides I ever made. And I had it there in my lab and didn't do anything with it. Like Darvon or something like
that.
Oh,
yeah, okay.
Phosphorus sulfur. Should have patented that.
But you weren't thinking about those uses or those materials at that time. Did Fry leave then when you took over?
Calvin Smith sent him back to Case to get some higher education, and he did, and the company paid for it, but he never came back to work for us. I think I know one reason.
Do you suspect that the difficulty he had was because you had a PhD and he didn't?
It's the only thing I can think of. He didn't have problems with anybody else.
Well, that was quite a responsibility to take on then, this, in a very short time. You were given a lot of responsibility.
Yeah.
What did you do first?
Well, I'd been working there on the bench myself, and I knew all the other chemists, and I knew what they were doing, and we cooperated back and forth, you know, talked to each other. It was a very friendly group, and all I did after that was sit down occasionally with them and say, what do we do now, and what kind of compounds do we think we ought to make? And, you know, we worked jointly and figured out some new products, and we got some pretty good ones. And the company was so successful that, unbelievably, They're written up in the Plain Dealer as one of the fastest growing companies in the country in the chemical industry. In the days I was there, 40 years. And I can tell you that the growth there was in excess of 10% compounded, both in revenues and earnings, for all those 40 years. Mm-hmm. Sometimes even more, 15 or so percent. So that company really grew rapidly and very successful. They were the first company that went into this business and trying to improve lubricants by additives to the lubricants. And the war came along at that time, and the military started using them, and that really boosted the company's revenues a great deal during that First World War, or second. They bought a lot of it, and that got the automotive industry into it and so forth.
Well, when you joined, the war was already on, so that must have been a very busy and active time.
Yeah, that's right.
What would you say, you commented that you really just sort of let people have freedom in exploring different kinds of things. Were there any restrictions you placed on them? I'm talking about doing basic research as opposed to applied research.
No, I don't think I put any restrictions on them. If we discussed things, I mean, I knew every product everybody was trying to make. And I'm sure that at times somebody would say, why don't we try this? And maybe I'd say, no, that's too difficult or something like that. I was the only PhD in the group for a while there, see. And I knew my organic chemistry better than any rest of them, presumably at least. And so we'd pick out things that I had to prove. Anything that they try to manufacture, you know, to synthesize in the laboratories. And I knew what had already been made and what some of them were beginning to look promising and interesting. So we continued in that area somewhat. One of the most creative chemists that I hired later on is still one of my best friends. It was Bill LeSueur. And that fellow had more brilliant ideas than any of us in the lab. Mm. And he came back over the years. He was working there almost as long as I did. He had about 50 patents of products that he thought were worth making. And most of them were useful, and he was one of the very brilliant fellows.
Did you continue to do any lab work yourself, or did you stop working at the bench?
I stopped working at the bench not right away. I did some work at the lab and the bench at the bench for a while there. I don't know how long, because it wasn't far beyond that I was given the job of directing research and development, which was a pilot plant, and I was pretty busy. After I got that part, I don't think I did any more work in the lab.
One of the things one of the things that I've noted about looking at the history of Lubrizol is that there was always a large percentage of the employees engaged in research, probably more so than most other companies.
I think that was true.
What was the company thinking in terms of having that situation?
Well, the number one man there, founders, there were six founders, but the one man who did most all of the direction of the company's policies and what have you was Calvin Smith. And he was a research person himself. He is a chemical engineer. And his thinking, I'm sure, he was a very close friend of mine. I had a lot to do with him. Was the only way we're going to get ahead in this business is to do a lot of research, bring out a lot of compounds, and pick those that'll work, and many of them won't. And I think that was the policy that he set and made it succeed.
In the early days, how much research was, I'm going to put it under the heading trial and error, and as opposed to a theoretical background or more of an understanding of how these additives are functioning?
I don't know if I could answer that with any degree of certainty. We did both kinds of things, I know. We would try things that looked like out of the world, you know, probably wouldn't work and so forth, and sometimes they would. This Bill LeSueur that I mentioned, he came up with an idea that nobody else had had before, and putting dispersions in the oil to help solubilize the other products and so forth. And that turned out to be a tremendous product, I mean, line of products before it got through. They were very useful in keeping all the stuff soluble and dispersed in the oils and so forth. And he got a number of patents on that simple idea. So some of it was, you know, thinking ahead, theoretical, but we followed leads that we'd find in certain products that weren't quite good enough. Maybe if we do this to it, it'd be better. And that sort of thing. A lot of sulfur compounds, a lot of phosphorus compounds. The dispersants were nitrogen esters and complicated esters with nitrogens in them, amines and amides.
Can you tell me more about Calvin Smith and what kind of person was he to work for?
Well, he is, to me, he is one of the brightest brains I've ever met. And he, in effect, ran that company. But unfortunately, except for me, everybody else was scared of it. I mean that. There was a Canadian that worked there, headed up a pilot plant. Tremendous fellow. He told me once that every time he called into Calvin Smith's office, sits down in front of his desk and his toes curl up in his shoes. The guy scared people, but he was the most gentlemanly person I've ever met. Very polite, very quiet, very... I can't understand why people were scared of him, but most of them were. His secretary once lost her voice, and she'd been around there quite a while. Well, that's an interesting story. His secretary just couldn't talk, and he tried everything to get her back. There wasn't anything wrong. Her doctors looked at her, nothing wrong. Just mentally or something. Couldn't talk. But one day, he came to me and he said, this secretary's name was Earl. No, not Earl. I know. Anyway, he came to my office and said, would you call this gal in and talk with her? Of course, she hadn't talked for a week or 10 days. I said, well, what do you want me to say? I said, just whatever you want. So I called her in and sat down and I talked with her a while. I don't know what I said for sure. Just idle chatter. And then I finally made some statement and I said her name was Ethel or Evelyn, I forget. I said, "Do you agree with that?" She said, "Yes, I do." The first word she'd said for 10 days. And from there on, I talked with her, and she talked back, and everything was okay. Well, Kevin was very happy about this, and one day I asked him, "Well, how come you sent her in to talk with me?" And he said to me, and I'm not even sure what he meant, he says, "You have a sixth sense about people. That's why." Whatever that means. But he and I were very close friends, and many people were jealous of me because he and I would go out to lunch almost every day to talk over things. He told me all the problems that the company was having, and we discussed them, and of course I think that's why I got the topic.
Well, he must have had a great deal of confidence in you then to be able to pick you out as the person he would confide in and talk to that much.
Well, I've never quite understood it, but sorry. I had a throat that's bothering me today. He knew that people were afraid of him. And he knew that none of them were afraid of me. And that was true. I got along with everybody, no problems. And I ran an operation there that if some officer of the company made a mistake, they'd come over and talk to me about it. In manufacturing, vice president would come over. I'd goofed up here today. And they weren't afraid to tell me. And we'd talk about it, and I'd say, "Well, you won't do that again." "No, I don't see." So I think that's part of it, that maybe I had a sixth sense about me, whatever that means. And I had, they're all friends of mine. It was just like a big family, except for Kelvin.
Yes, he was what, one of three brothers?
Yes.
And there was another brother who preceded him, is that correct?
Yes, the Kent Smith was the oldest of the three brothers, and he was, I guess he was chairman or something of the board for a while there, and I don't think Calvin ever took the job as chairman of the board. He just ignored that. Then Vincent, the third brother, he really had his own business and didn't do a lot with Overshaw, except he was a member of the board and about it.
One of the things that intrigued me was early on, I know there was a connection with their father and Herbert Dow.
Yeah.
And that there were several attempts made to get Dow Chemical interested in making some of these things, but Dow never expressed any interest in doing that. Is that correct?
I don't know that. I'm not sure. I know that the Smith brother's father was a key individual in establishing the Dow Chemical Company, and I'm sure that it could very well happen that since he was involved in that, that they might have requested some work for Dow, or Dow may have, I don't know, whatever. I've never really had a whole lot of knowledge about that operation or how it came about.
So while you were directing research and then, well, when you got into research and development, comfortable did you feel with taking over the development aspects and setting up manufacturing?
No problem.
Okay.
I knew everybody. It was a small company. And That's one of the reasons I said I wasn't going to work for a big company. I knew everybody worked for Lubrizol, and I was friendly with them. And I don't believe there was more than 200 or I don't know how many there were when I was put into the job. It wasn't very many people. It grew rapidly after that, but I think at one time there was about 400 in there. I may have been executive VP or something at that time.
But the 50s was, is that 50s, early 60s when the foreign expansion took place as well, and were you involved in that?
The what's expansion?
Foreign, going into foreign countries.
Oh, yeah. We had a vice president of manufacturing who was an engineer. And the first plant that we put out of the country was in France. And he was over there while that was built. He was the vice president of the corporation, a very capable person on building structures and all that. And of course, he was also in charge of putting the Houston plant in. That was the second U.S. plant we put together. He was there when that was built. Roger Clapp was his name, and he's still living, a very good friend of mine. And we get together once in a while and talk about the old days.
So that's great. But the research efforts stayed all stayed here in Wycliffe. Is that correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how did you interact in the research area with the other plant locations? Did you help them in solving problems?
Well, I visited most all those plants at one time or another, and it turned out that they never did very much manufacturing. We had one in England and France, also plenty in South Africa somewhere, and Great Britain, and actually had one in Japan and Australia, all over. And our the products that we sold, I can remember this figure, that 75% of them, while I was still there, were sold overseas, only about 25% in the U.S. So we covered the whole area of the world, and we were, again, about the first people involved in that business. That's why we grew so much, so rapidly. A dog heard somebody at the bell.
The bell rang, yes. I read somewhere that you, when you became president in 73, and I guess you had already figured that Roger Clapp had picked you to take that position.
Yeah, he was in advance of me.
That you really disdained what you called the rituals of modern management.
Yeah.
And you just said you didn't believe in taking these courses for managing courses and so on, did you?
That's right. I didn't believe in that. I still think it's a waste of time. Well, maybe it's changed. No, I wouldn't send anybody to management schools. There was an article, there was some magazine came to interview the company in the 70s. And I can't think of the name of it. It was a business magazine. And they asked these kind of questions of me. And I told them why. And they had that as a sub-headline in the article that was published. And then also, Les Coleman was at that time executive vice president. They went in to interview him. He had a book on his desk by Drucker, who was a management expert. And when this reporter came in, he says, "Geez, I better take this book off my desk. Masson might see it." Well, they put that in the magazine, in the article. And I got letters from all over the world. It was because it was an international magazine. And some of them had said, "What an arcane title company you must operate." And many of them said, "I'd sure like to work for this company." And, you know. But I thought that at that time, and I still think it's true, and I think it's beginning to be proved now that management education is not really worth all it's cracked up to be. And the people that get out of Harvard, for example, think that, well, they're going to be the next president. You know, that doesn't work that way.
Well, your sixth sense for people, I think that's one of the keys, is the relationship you have with the people that work with you.
Could be. I don't know. I don't even know what a sixth sense is. I thought we only had five.
When I talked to Ray Boundy, who was research director at Dow for a number of years, he used the term accountable freedom.
Accountable freedom?
Freedom in dealing with his people. In other words, they were accountable, yet they had flexibility to make decisions and do things and work on their own projects that would benefit the company.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that kind of thing applied to your style also?
Yes, I think so, very much so. We had group leaders in the lab. We had four or five or six working with them. They're supposed to take care of that group and get ideas, and it was freedom. And everybody that worked there, and I've talked with most of them, they say they just love that work. And nobody was upset about anything. It was like a big family, really. And that was part of the success, the reason for it, the success. People just loved working there.
That was one of my general questions, was how do you how do you nurture innovation? How do you get your people to be innovative and creative?
I don't know. I was always one to go out, even as president, go out and talk to the research people and ask how they're doing and what new ideas you got, and that sort of thing. Research was the main reason for Lubrizol's success, no question about it, in my mind. And so I spent a lot of time, after I was a top executive there, working with the research people. And I also, of course, went to meetings of manufacturing and all the others, but that was the most interesting to me. And I don't know how, whether I inspired them for any reason, but they knew that if they were successful, they'd be rewarded one way or another, and everybody'd be happy with them, and so forth. I don't really know any better answer than that.
As I understand it, the company had a, I'm going to call it a profit-sharing kind of situation from the early days. Is that correct?
Yeah. They sold, well, first of all, they had a, they put money away in a fund that was to be distributed eventually to people. And they went on the New York Stock Exchange in 1962. Prior to that, however, they sold stock based on a formula of some sort to what they called the key employees. And The first stock I was offered was 50 shares, and the price at that point, according to the formula, was $75 a share. And that was when that was in 1943. And I had become a key employee since I was head of research. And I didn't have enough money to buy $75 times 50. And I bought 5 shares. I was able to scrape up enough money. But after that, I borrowed all the money I could from Cleveland Trust and 3% interest, and bought every stock that I was offered from there on, every share of stock. Because I thought I was foolish for not borrowing money to begin with. And I'd only been there less than a year the first time. So after that, the stock was put on the market, 62, so anybody could buy it. A lot of them did, including me. We had a program of stock options also. Roger Clapp and I decided one day, after we'd taken a lot of these options, that we weren't going to take any more have the other people do it, and we stopped taking any further options. But he and I had enough and didn't need it.
One of the other things that we've touched on briefly is, and it was part of my general questions as well, was the scientific teamwork. Your people were the teamwork involved with your research group, as opposed to people operating individually. How would you describe that Lube result?
Well, as I mentioned, they had a group leader with maybe 4 or 5 working under him, and I would say they worked as a team, and every month or so we'd have research meetings where we discuss what's been going on, what progress has been made, and I would say that almost every research person there was aware of what each of the others were doing, and if they had an idea on this fellow's work, go talk to him. I mean, we all knew what everybody else was working on, pretty much. If we got a little bigger and figured that wasn't always true, it was in the beginning, I think. And I think it was perfect teamwork to do it that way.
The company had to respond to the changes in the industry, and there were certainly a lot of those changes.
Yeah.
In terms of the needs and the requirements. How did you keep aware of these changes?
The military, during that war, set up specifications for the lubricants that they would buy from us or anybody else. And those specifications were pretty strict. They had to go through a whole series of tests. And at that point, the whole industry changed into these military specifications that anybody in the business would have to meet before they could sell products. And that means to companies outside the military. So those specs are still in effect, and they change all the time. So I think it was the military's need that caused that major change. And from there on in, we have one of the biggest mechanical test laboratories in the country at that time, and still do. We had to run a lot of engine tests, a lot of gear tests, And they're all set up initially by the U.S. military, and they're still, I don't know if the military is involved in it too much anymore, but that's the way it started. So we had to put in a lot of equipment to meet those specs at the beginning.
When you were CEO, I think was the time when the environmental concerns became more important than government regulations and that kind of thing. What were your experiences with that?
Well, we were there in Wycliffe, and some of the products we made didn't smell very good, so we had some complaints from neighbors around there. One woman particularly always after us. So we had to be careful about leaving any odors out in the air, and we did a good job, I think, in correcting that problem. And also, we were very careful about materials that would leave the laboratory. We would never put them out in a river or a ditch or anything like that. We had systems set up where they would be destroyed or burned up or whatever. We would never pollute anything, including the air. That was a policy, and we stuck with it.
So when the government started to regulate this, you were already in...
We had no problem. Except with this one woman in the neighborhood. And she wanted to give us a problem all the time.
How did you deal with her? Did you have to deal with her, or did somebody else?
No, personnel.
Is it still company policy to have such a high percentage of its employees in research?
Well, I think so. We're just putting in a new research lab, as a matter of fact, right now. And I don't know how many are in there now and what percentage of the total employee is, but it's high. And I hope it stays that way.
But that is sort of contrary to what's happening in the chemical industry today, isn't it? Research and development are not receiving high priority as they used to.
Could be. I don't know why that should be. Maybe it's because they spent more money than it hadn't paid off. A lot of companies, I'm sure, wasted money on research. Lubrizol may be wasting some now, but I'm not involved, so I don't know.
What would you say were the major changes in the chemical industry that you saw during your career?
That's a hard one. I haven't given it any thought, frankly. Of course, I know that there's been a lot of materials that composite-type materials in recent years, for example, synthetic rubber. That started way back when Speed Marble was involved in that. And the plastics industry is a very important one. That's chemistry. All these polymers that I was working with in Speed Marble, they make all kinds of products out of those. I think that was one of the major changes when we learned how to polymerize vinyl materials. And as you know, that's a major industry now all over. And they're made not only by chemical companies, but by everybody else.
What do you think is important for the future of the chemical industry, and especially in terms of chemical innovation, new ideas?
I've never asked that question of myself. Since I left Lubrizol and retired, my major activity is my hobbies, and that is not connected with chemistry at all. I go back and visit some of the people once in a while. I had lunch out there not too long ago with a number of the research people, but I'd have to answer that by saying, after I retired, I forgot chemistry and went back to photography and nature studies. And I've traveled all over the world and taken photographs of every animal and bird and collected birds, and that kept me very happy. And I don't think I paid much attention to what was happening in the chemical industry.
When you received the SCI medal in New York, your talk was somewhat unusual.
It was?
Well, in the sense that if you look at what others had to say, this was, I think I have it here somewhere.
If you don't, I've got a copy here. My file. Intelligence of Life.
Yes, yes.
Well,
why did you select that particular topic?
Because I was interested in, for the first time pretty much, in DNA. And the whole subject, as I recall it, had to do with that as the code of life. And that is a chemical. And I thought that someday it's going to be a major area of chemistry, possibly. And I remember a friend of mine, after I gave that talk, he worked for Johnson & Johnson, and they were working on this stuff. I said, how did you ever learn all about that stuff? I said, well, I read about it. So it was a new area. And the intelligence of life, I don't know if that was a good title, but I meant to say that by that title, that the DNA is the key, or is the code of life. And of course, intelligence has to do with the brain. That's a lot of DNA in there. There's only about 10 billion neurons in the brain. Every one of them has DNA in it. So, you know, it's tied together.
What did receiving that award mean to you from the SCI?
Well, the only thing I can remember about it offhand is that my wife and I stood there in the doorway and shook hands with about 600 people, and I had to have a stool to sit on after I got out of there. And I don't know that it meant a great deal to me. I was glad to get it, of course, but I don't think I would say it was a key feature of my life by any means. It was just one of those things that happened, and I went out and accepted it.
Okay. I've sort of reached the end of my question list. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I will say that I consider myself now as a naturalist and not a chemist, but I read three or four technical magazines which I keep up with what's going on in chemical areas of significance anyway, and but as a retired chemist for 12 years now, I would say that is of less interest to me than it was back in the days I was at Louisville, quite a bit. So I don't know. I concentrate on certain things, apparently.
Well, I'd like to thank you for spending time with me this morning.
And, well, there's a lot of questions. I didn't know what you were going to ask. I hope I answered them all right.
Oh, no, that was fine. I got some, there's some good information there. And
what are you going to do with these things?
Well, right now, we are going to transcribe these and put these in our archives. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping to do some writing after we get all of this information put together. I'd like to do some writing, primarily in the area of chemical innovation. And you're now the fifth person I've talked to. What's intrigued me is that it's different in each setting. Huh. There's a different way of operating, but it's very successful within that setting. But it might not be successful. There's what you did at Lubrizol might not work at Nalco Chemical, for example.
I can believe that.
And that's showing up very early on in these interviews, so it's very intriguing.
Well, I was lucky to have taken a job at Louisville. You're not on there now, are you?
Yes. Do you want me to turn it off?
Yeah.
Okay.